Coming up on this week's show, a way to preserve your N64 games forever.
One of the biggest games of all time comes to the Dreamcast.
And we chat to one of the world's longest running Amiga retailers, Matthew from Amiga King.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every week with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, one of my favourite books they've ever done, The Art of Point-and-Click Adventure Games. Now, I'm a huge fan of old-school point-and-clicks. If you are as well, this celebrates everything about that genre, packed with gorgeous imagery from the golden era of adventure gaming. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection. Have a look at their website at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely mates at PCBWay. Now, of course, you know about PCBWay. They offer top quality, fast turnaround PCBs and also services like 3D printing and CNC milling. And you know they're big supporters of the retro community. So if you're working on something right now, get an instant quote on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 415, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast. And, you know, we love this. We never take it for granted, the fact that every week, you know, people tune in to hear three nerds geek out about old school video games. That is what this show is at its heart, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a round table chat. It's just three mates getting together. We ain't experts. We just give our opinions on a couple of games. And then the best part is we interview a couple of industry legends at the end as well, don't we?
That is it. We're living the dream, because, you know, when we set this podcast up, it's like the idea is, you know, we get to talk to the people who made the video games that we grew up playing. That was a big focus of the show. And it's expanded so much since we started doing the podcast. You know, magazines, we cover retailers, which we're going to be talking about this week as well. People making new indie games. We get out to shows as well. And I know, actually, you had a really busy weekend. Last weekend, Joe, you actually met a few listeners in person and made a few quid on your classic games.
I did. I was up at the Leeds video game market, and a couple of people came up and said hey, which is always wonderful, always nice to meet people and everything, and yeah, really, really good time. But
it looked rammed, mate, from the photos that I saw. It looked heaving.
It was heaving, and the Doncaster one's just been announced for May, which I think I'll be at as well. It was heaving, to say the least, and it was a long day, so I was extremely tired by the end of it, but absolutely loved it, loved the atmosphere. It was absolutely electric, and it just reminds you that the retro game scene is still alive and kicking, for sure.
Yeah, it's really weird, because when obviously we're going to be talking to our special guest this week, Matthew Lehman, who we'll talk more about in a moment. But actually, before we started recording, he said, you know, someone was telling him the other day that we're kind of getting to the age now where they kind of think the retro peak might have happened and it should be starting to come down in the next few years. But definitely don't see any of that from events and stuff that I've been to. It just seems like it's getting bigger all the time.
Yeah, getting bigger all the time. Me and my mate Jason were always thinking, like, oh, the price is going to crash. You know,
Is
the bubble going to burst? But I don't know. People have been saying that for a couple of years now, and it still hasn't happened. So we'll see. But we'll still be here if that does happen. We'll still be here talking, chatting about all this nonsense. And
chatting about nothing, because there's no retro anymore.
But we'll be retro by then, guys.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll talk about ourselves. But I know you're at a nice little event in Nottingham on Friday night as well. It's celebrating indie games. A lot of retro stuff there as well, Ravi.
Yeah, it was really nice. It was the first Debug Indie Games Awards, and you know, Debug magazine specialise in covering indie games, and we cover a lot of indie games on this show, and you know, indie games that kind of have a retro theme, and it was quite nice to actually see some of them in person, because you know, we've talked about some of these games, but actually seeing the developers there getting some recognition on stage was really nice. And it was like a proper award ceremony, but you could also sit and play with the game. So I came with Paul Jury from Retro Gaming Magazine, and the Ted Dabney Experience as well, which is a really good podcast, I recommend.
And the Retro Hour Christmas Quiz, obviously. Most famous for that, I'd say, yeah. Probably, yeah.
Yeah, always. Well, not on the winning team last time, but yeah.
I hope you rub that in.
It was a great event, and, you know, seeing some of the games like Videoverse won an award, and Videoverse was one that we talked about. Very nice, stylized game. It was kind of based in this fantasy, like MSM hybrid kind of Miiverse kind of area. And, you know, it's all about social media. That one was great to see that. And then There was also low-tech games there as well. They've got some titles that have come out on the NES, and they've got like an item called the Parasite Pack, and Flea has come out on there, which was nice to sit down and play Flea, which is a nice piece of homebrew. And also another one which is quite like Choo Choo Rocket, which is called Choo Choo Mimic, which came out, and that's in collaboration with Rigged Games as well, who's John Riggs. He's quite a famous YouTuber as well.
He came out from America, didn't he, for the event?
Yeah, he was actually there, from America. People flew from all over to come to this event because it was a real, you know, first-time celebration, and I hope it happens every single year. Trista Bytes was hosting as well and did a fantastic job, you know, getting everybody involved. And another game that was really notable was Full Void. And it was great to see the Full Void crew because they were like, oh, you mentioned us on the Retro Hour, and we were all excited. And it's just like, oh, wow, you know, because Full Void's been picked for the Evercade to actually come out on that. So seeing some of these titles was just fantastic in person. And the indie games world and the retro world, they kind of combine in certain places.
Yeah, quite a lot, I'd say. Cause, I mean, obviously I've been to one event where I always see that is Pixel Heaven.
Yeah.
And I go to that over in Poland. I'd say probably about, you know, it's 50-50 split between indie and retro stuff. But it, like you said, there's such a big crossover. And a lot of similar fans as well. A lot of people are into both, aren't they? So I think definitely there's, you know, people have got their feet in both camps.
Yeah, Sobi Tech was there. There were a few you know, previous people we've had on the podcast as well. You know, PC Zone Magazine. And yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I'd love to have come to that. Unfortunately, I was in London at the weekend, went to see the Back to the Future musical. So not quite retro gaming, but definitely retro related.
Sounds cool,
yeah, which was a great laugh on Saturday afternoon when we saw that. So that's the thing, now that January's out the way, it just kind of feels like, you know, it's going to be like this for like the next 6 months now. Just events on, like, you know, every couple of weeks, and definitely one of the highlights when we get into that time of year. And obviously we're talking about last week that your big Amiga event's going to be coming up in Nottingham this summer in June, at the end of June, Kickstart 02 for Amiga fans. And actually today on the podcast, we're going to be talking to someone who was an exhibitor at your show last year, but someone that we've known for a very long time. And anyone that goes to Amiga events around the world will be familiar with our guest this week, because actually some people are not into the Amiga world. You know, this might surprise Joe, for example, who's, you know, many a console fan. But Matthew, our guest this week, has made a full-time job out of selling Amiga products for 20 years now.
It's pretty amazing, because I remember Matthew from the dark days. With the Amiga, there was a big collapse of Commodore, and pretty much everyone kind of left. They were bought by ESCOM, and there was Gateway and all of this kind of
messy story.
Yeah, lots of mess for many years. And at one point, Amiga Kit was one of the only companies where I could actually buy anything. You know, there are a few other retailers as well, but you'd have to get little bits from one person, little bits from the other. And, you know, they've survived all this time and turned it into a business. And they're also releasing a new console as well, the A600GS, which is pretty amazing, because I think this is the first time they've dipped their toe into creating a little machine.
Yeah, now we did kind of touch on this briefly last week when you and I were like basically doing our 10-minute Amiga geek out that we regularly do when Joe normally goes off for a drink.
Yeah, this is why Joe's silent at the moment. Yeah, he's just like over his head.
I'm just like, yeah, Amigas.
Well, guess what? Joe did borrow my Amiga 500 Mini, didn't you, last year?
I did.
You had it for a couple of weeks and playing around with it. And obviously, that's kind of been the system that, in terms of kind of modern Amiga hardware, has been getting the most attention over the last year or two, which is, you know, a device that you can walk into a mainstream shop. You know, they sell them in like HMV and Game here. You plug it into your telly. It's got a lister on there with a bunch of built-in games. Put a USB stick in with your own downloaded games. Play them, plug and play, dead simple. But the first thing I did when I got my A500 Mini, and, you know, people might have watched my YouTube video on this, is I basically tried to hack it and put the Amiga operating system on there and load Workbench and run applications. Because to me, that was a big part of the Amiga. I mean, obviously, I played a load of games on the machine, but I also loved, you know, playing around in, you know, Deluxe Paint and trying my hand at, you know, even though I was terrible at it, making music on the machine and, you know, which I've got some tracks that will never see the light.
I want to hear those tracks done.
No, nobody wants to hear these tracks. But I mean, that was such a big part of the Amiga as well. So I mean, this system that they've made, which is coming out in a couple of months' time, it's called the A600GS. It's going to be very competitively priced. We'll hear more about that with Matthew soon. It is basically a small device. It's around the size of maybe a pack of cards that will have some legacy ports on there, so you can plug in like a classic Amiga joystick and a mouse. But really, even though this will run all of your classic Amiga games, they're focusing this a bit more at the market that might want to run things like, you know, Octomed or Personal
Pain. Yeah, kind of, you know, the applications, but also, like, there's so much choice out there. It, you know, there was at one point where Amiga Kit kind of started that hardly any hardware was coming out, full stop. Yeah. Now we've got so many choices and so many options. It's absolutely great to see all of this activity and all these machines and devices coming out. So we're going to talk to Matthew about the company's history, but we're also going to talk in detail about the device because, you know, we've had many devices on this show and details and stuff. So hopefully, you know, if you've been wondering about it, you'll be able to pick up some information in this.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've had friends who've bought Amiga 500, you know, the A500 minis to basically try and use them as, like, you know, Amiga computers, you know, obviously, which
I've got friends that are putting PlayStation games on them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, God, you can do so much with it now. But having a device that is, you know, basically targeted towards the people who want to use the creative side of the Amiga in 2024 and, you know, having an internet-connected device as well. There's like a store on there. So we'll hear all about that and kind of a bit about, you know, the hardware side of it as well, what it's based on with our special guest, Matthew Lehman. He's coming up from Amiga Kit, the managing director on the podcast in around 35 minutes from now. But if you are a regular listener, you'll know the way the podcast normally works. The way we do it is our first half, we do a little roundtable chat a bit about what's been happening in retro from over the last week and bring you up to speed on all the big stories because we appreciate everyone's busy. Not everyone's got time to trawl all the social media sites and the websites like we do. So we give you the highlights of what's been happening over the last week. And speaking of platforms that have been getting quite a lot of love recently, and there have been we've talked about a few of these little devices recently for other platforms as well. Devices that can let you essentially back up your saved games and more, because this device goes way beyond that. This is something new for the Nintendo 64 called the Joey N64.
Yeah, this looks wicked. I spotted this on Nintendo Life, who've done a really good video about
I watched it this morning.
Yeah, I watched it this morning as well. It's about 9 minutes long. It's got several functions, which, you know, are all really cool. And the main one being you can back up your files from it, your games from it. You save games, yeah. So you literally plug it straight into your computer, and then the device itself, the Joey N64, is like just a flat piece of plastic with the cartridge pins on it to plug your N64 cartridges into, and then a N64 controller port. And to download your save files from the N64 memory card, you literally just put the N64 memory card into the back of the N64 controller as you had to with an N64.
Yeah.
And then just plug the controller straight into the Joey 64 and then that, you know, into your computer, and you literally just drag and drop them over. But what I found really interesting about the hardware of the Joey N64 is you don't need to download any software. As long as your computer recognizes USB drives, it recognizes it as a USB drive, and you literally just drag and drop it over, which is absolutely fantastic. And you can do the same with your cartridges. So you pop the cartridge into the cartridge slot of it, plug it into your computer, and you just drag the ROMs over from the cartridge into your computer, into the storage. And obviously you run it in emulation or whatever you want to do with it, copy onto another cartridge, etc. But there's two of the functions, so you can legally back up your games and save your save data, which in the video he says he's not really bothered about the save data because of a lot of the N64 games, if not most of them, you could save directly onto the cartridge and you didn't actually need a memory card. And if I remember rightly, they weren't the most reliable memory cards.
But then the batteries die in them sometimes. Mm. You know, it's a way of, I guess, preserving that. You know, if you have got quite far into a game and, you know, you don't want to lose it when the battery goes in your cart if it hasn't already.
Yeah, I guess so. But what I found really interesting was the part about where you can actually plug it straight into your iPhone.
Yeah.
And you can download an app on your iPhone. What that allows you to do is, say you're out and about, you're at a games market or you're in a game shop or something, and you come across a really rare, expensive N64 game, maybe StarCraft 64 Resident Evil 2.
You can rip the ROM at the...
No.
You probably could, to be fair.
But not a case of ripping the ROM. You don't want to part with your hard-earned cash because you're worried it's a fake game. It'll actually tell you if it's a legit game, if the files are legit, or if they're emulation, which is really interesting. Bit of a strange one if you're in the stood in the middle of a game, retro game shop, and you're like, can I plug this N64 cartridge?
Yeah, bearing in mind, if that's phone. A game, like you said, one of these games that costs like £300 or £400, yeah. I bet, what, are you really going to plug that into that weird device that's plugged into your phone? What is that doing? Yeah, it might take some convincing.
You need like a wrist mount and like an extension lead and then do it on the sly.
But yeah, a really cool little device. The biggest downfall that they've said is it is sold out instantly. £50 for one, which isn't too
$50
bad. $50 are sold out at the moment, so keep your eyes peeled if more are produced to go on sale, but I'm sure they will, seeing as though it's sold out immediately.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've seen a few of these for other systems. We're talking about a PlayStation one, I think, a while ago, weren't we? Wake up, back up your PlayStation saves. I mean, I must admit, I've been playing on my N64 recently because we're doing a new episode of the After Hours podcast, which has been delayed slightly because I had my AV cable died for my N64, which I mentioned on the show last week. But I did spend a good hour and a half or so on a game on Sunday night that we're going to be talking about on the Patrons Only podcast. And I got quite far into that game, and I thought, well, I've saved it on my original N64 memory card. But there's probably not that many I've got that I'd care that much to back up the saves. But I guess there will be people that maybe got to a certain level, you know, in a game 25 years ago, and you want to keep that forever. I think that aspect of it, I guess, you know, that there is definitely, it's a niche audience, I think. And obviously the fact that most N64 games have already been dumped anyway.
Yeah.
But for some people, there is just something.
Legal.
That is one aspect of it. It's a legal way of doing it. But it's weird because, I mean, all the Amiga games have been, you know, dumped, all the discs, you know, pretty much every variant of Amiga games available to download online. But still, I've actually backed up a lot of my original discs I've got here just because they were my copy of it. I know it sounds weird. It's just data. It's just bits and bytes. But the fact that I've got a backup on my machine of my original discs that I got when I was a kid, you know, my copy of it's preserved. I know it probably doesn't make a lot of sense. And again, it probably is quite a niche thing, but I think there will be an audience that wants to preserve their own collection of games. And like you said, you know, the fact that you can, I think that legal, you know, that legit checker that's in there to see if they're original carts or not, I think that is probably a big selling point for hardcore collectors. So for $50, though, I think, you know, anyone that's got an N64 will be a nice little addition to their collection. So if you want to check that out and keep an eye on the link for when that becomes available, I'll link that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, Minecraft is a game that appears can run on a load of different platforms. I remember running Minecraft on my Power Mac G5.
That must have been the Java version of it, right?
Yeah, I think it either ran in Java or JavaScript, wasn't it? I can't remember. I think it was Java, the original build of Minecraft ran in. And I remember running it on a G5 Mac, which you've got to think in terms of timeline. I think I got that in around, the machine I've got is quite a late G5, probably around 2005. So probably about 20 years ago now. Got a decent graphics card for the day in there, you know, dual core CPUs, and running Minecraft on it, it ran in a window, but actually it was a little bit laggy. It felt like it was using like, you know, 100% of the CPU to kind of play the game. It was playable, you know, at a reasonable frame rate, but it is one of those games where I think a lot of people looked at it when it came out and they were like, you know, the graphics look like really rudimentary, like, and these look like 8-bit graphics, but actually for the time it was, you know, a reasonably demanding game. For the hardware, you had to have, you know, you couldn't run it on like your standard office PC at a comfortable frame rate. But actually, it turns out that this has been quite amazing to see, actually. People have got it running, a version of Minecraft called their Classy Cube, which is basically a custom client for Minecraft Classic, written from scratch in C. It's basically a fan reinterpretation of it, the creator mode of Minecraft. Someone's got this running very smoothly in alpha state on the Sega Dreamcast. What do you guys think of this?
I've never played Minecraft. Okay.
What?
Yeah.
An omission, Joe. We should have got you to play that for the after hours we're doing this weekend.
I was mentioning the Java. I was like an original Minecrafter from those Java days. And it's a very different game. It's changed a lot. It's a whole kind of ecosystem and world now with learning and, you know, so many functions that you can do. And add-ons and stuff. I kind of got lost in it, but I do really prefer this classic old kind of version of Minecraft and how it was back in the days. But it's such a popular title. It's also not just for kids as well.
Yeah. I mean, I remember getting it when it was, it was Notch, wasn't it, the guy that was behind it originally?
Yeah.
I remember getting that in, right, must have been when it first came out, around 2009, I think it was. I remember downloading that on my probably Windows Vista or Windows 7 PC, whichever one I had around that time. And I think I paid about £9 to register the game because you could,
yeah,
it was a free version.
Originally with Mojang, and then later on you could upgrade that and keep upgrading it, you know.
Which I think I've still got on my PC to this day. You know, that original kind of, you know, £9, £10 copy that I bought back then. But I mean, it is a game that obviously kids kind of took over it. It became known as kind of a kid's game. But originally, I mean, there was quite a big geek kind of adult community in the Minecraft world.
I think there still is. It all depends because there's all these add-ons, there's all these different functions. You know, you can have mod packs on there. Modding is a huge thing. You can change the entire kind of title, and you know, stuff like Roblox has spawned from it as well, which is a huge thing, and it's kind of defined that whole genre of games and definitely brought stuff like crafting into popular titles as well.
Well, this project on GitHub, which I'll link up, which has now been ported to the Dreamcast, it's called a Classy Cube, and I was kind of a little bit aware of this, but I hadn't looked too deeply into it until today. And it turns out it's been ported to a load of different systems. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a Windows and Mac OS port, runs on Linux as well. There's iOS and Android ports. There's even ports for stuff like OpenBSD and Haiku and Solaris. And someone's actually made a version of it for the Silicon Graphics workstations running on Irix.
Oh, wow.
Which, obviously, Silicon Graphics were, you know, very impressive back in the 90s. But now someone's got, you know, Minecraft running very well on this machine as well. Looks like there's a version on the N64.
Yeah,
from the GitHub page too.
I think the things that really eat up the memory with Minecraft and like similar clone titles as well, because this is Classy Cube, it's usually the NPCs in it. NCPs. I can never say that.
Non-playable characters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. NPCs. And also, NPCs, also the world, the size of the world and the size of the map. And looking at this, you know, it looks like quite a small window and the world is quite small and the draw distance isn't huge either, you know. No. They're on a small island and stuff, and that's probably bearable. I couldn't imagine what it would be like loading in a huge world. You'd probably get down to like you know, this is hitting about 60 frames per second on some of the stuff. You'd probably get down to a lot lower than that, but
the resolution, it looks very sharp.
But yeah, it looks great as well. And then consider you'd have the VGA output as well on the Dreamcast. It's very impressive for a console of its generation.
Yeah, something, you know, a system that came out in 1999, and it's basically an alpha state right now, just to kind of prove that the engine can run on the Dreamcast. Only landed this week, and basically, like you said, Ravi, you can just kind of walk around it. But hopefully, I mean, I'm looking at this and I think it's got all the framework there to kind of build this into a, you know, a playable world, and hopefully we'll get the characters and stuff in there and, you know, actually be able to do some stuff in it.
It'd be cool if they had like Dreamcast skins as well. And,
yes.
you could do like the Virtua Tennis guys.
Yeah, or Sonic or something in Minecraft. Yeah. That'd be pretty cool. So there is a nice little walk around on YouTube on a channel called Video Game Esoterica. Does like a 9-minute kind of walk around and shows you kind of how well it runs. And like you said, it kind of, it's basically locked into around 58 to 60 FPS throughout most of this video. So the fact that that is running, I think, is, you know, technically very impressive on the Dreamcast. So we'll keep an eye on the development of that. But it's nice to see Minecraft landing on the Sega Dreamcast. So I've got more stories to talk about in a moment, including a big indie game that has come to the, is being made in the style of N64 games, if you're an N64 fan, and also a classic Amiga title that could be coming back for 2024. Before we do that, though, you might remember that just before Christmas, I think it was back in November, I know this is one of your favourite episodes that we've done in a long time, Joe, being our resident horror fan.
Absolutely.
And we caught up with Dan Richardson, who is involved in this huge new documentary, a mega documentary, if you like, dedicated to horror video games, which I think he's going to clock in at over 5 hours long, called Terabytes.
Yeah, man. Yeah, this is going to be absolutely huge. So we had to get Dan back on for a couple of minutes just to kind of reveal some of the huge names, some of the titans of that genre and industry who are going to be involved. Some really surprising names as well that they've managed to get involved in it. So yeah, let's catch up with Dan.
Yeah, because we did tease, like, you know, kind of that there is some big names involved when we had him on back in November. Mm-hmm. And also we can reveal that now, if you want to get hold of the documentary, pre-orders have just gone live yesterday. So we thought, like you said, good chance to get Dan back on the podcast. How's it going, Dan? Welcome back.
Very glad to be here. Thank you for having me again.
Is it too late to say Happy New Year? I think it feels like a while ago now.
I think January is your cutoff point.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
Each other just a week or so ago would have been all right. Yeah. Now it's like...
Well, obviously Terabytes, as we mentioned, is finally here. So for people that might have missed that episode, just give us a little synopsis on what this project's about.
Yeah, sure thing. So Terabytes is the latest documentary from Creator VC. We are the development team behind In Search of Darkness, which is a franchise documentary series looking at 80s horror films. And we recently took our first foray into the video game world with FPS Doc, which was a look at the 50-year plus legacy of the first-person shooter genre, featuring guests like John Romero, John Carmack, Warren Spector, all the big names. So our latest thing is obviously Terabytes, and we are looking at horror gaming. So what we've done for this documentary is we have gathered up some of the titans of that industry, and we are looking to explore this genre of genres, if you will. It isn't one that sort of fits neatly into a box. It kind of has a little bit of everything. There's survival horror, there's FMV games of the 90s, there's indie hits and all of those kind of wonderful things. And we've just sort of really honed in on all of these little small pockets of horror within the medium of gaming, and took people from those pockets and had them fully explore all of the intricacies and emotional decisions behind all of the creative work we love so much.
So you mentioned some titans of the industry there. Can we ask who's going to be involved in the documentary?
To be honest, I could literally give you the whole list. There's really no weak links here. We're very, very, very happy with our cast, and the cast list is still growing. But to give you some highlights, again, not that anybody in this thing wouldn't be a highlight, they're all very good. We have the likes of Matthew Cote and Dave Richard, who are the co-directors of Dead by Daylight, obviously the massive smash hit asymmetrical horror that has every license under the sun. At this point, it's basically the Super Smash Brothers of horror games. We have indie creators like Adorf and Dave Szymanski, who made Faith, the Unholy Trinity, and Iron Lung, respectively. We have classics like the Williams couple, Roberta and Ken Williams, who obviously were the co-founders of Sierra Online. So we've got them in to talk about things like Phantasmagoria. Personal favorite of mine, we have a man who I genuinely consider to be the greatest composer in video games. He is probably matched only by the likes of Nobuo Uematsu and Koji Kondo. We have Silent Hill composer, producer, and sound designer Akira Yamaoka.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there's so much more I could say, but if I started listing everybody, we'd be here all day. It's an absolute mammoth cast, and I really encourage you guys, if you're listening, look at the website, click on the cast list, and just see some of the names we've got attached to this. It's a really impressive list of just some of the most important names in the genre, and I'm really excited to dig into their brains and their stories and just really celebrate their achievements within this medium.
You know, when we had you on last time, you mentioned about you had a survey that was running on your website where people could go on there and basically tell you what they wanted from this documentary. Have you had a lot of feedback then? Has that kind of helped? How's that kind of shaped it?
Yeah. It's a huge reason why Akira Yamaoka is there.
Nice.
Oh, wow. So we do genuinely listen to our, you know, sort of survey responses. Like, we're not one of these people who's like, oh, you know, answer this and we'll just get your marketing email. We literally read like every response. And Akira Yamaoka is somebody we were, you know, wanted to get anyway, but it's a pretty difficult connection with the, you know, the language barrier and the international difference. But when we saw how much he was requested within the surveys, it was kind of a thing of like, we can't not. And a lot of people who have been requested in the surveys are people who service in the cast. It kind of reaffirms some of the decisions we already had in mind, but it also helped us in informing kind of more off the wall talent. So we've got like a lot of kind of more indie creators who would have been on our radar but weren't necessarily in the space from the moment we decided to make the documentary.
Right.
So we've got like creators like Akuma Kira, and if you don't know who they are, they developed Spooky's Jump Scare Mansion, which was kind of like a big development in the mascot horror scene, you know, sort of alongside Five Nights at Freddy's and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have like some, you know, we're talking, we've got people who kind of span so much of this history. We've got people, like I say, going all the way back to Phantasmagoria. We've got Rob Fulop, who is the designer of Night Trap, which is a brilliantly cheesy, controversial game. I'm sure if anybody knows the game in history, will be very familiar with. But then we go all the way up to the modern day, and we have Black Tabby Games, that is the couple Abby and Tony Howard. They made the very recent title Slay the Princess, which is a really interesting cosmic horror, multi-narrative branching path visual novel. It's a really fascinating game. I encourage you to check it out.
Well, it's great to see that this has finally come to fruition and people can get hold of it now. That's one thing. I mean, you know, people look at the previous films that you guys have worked on, you know, In Search of the Last Action Heroes, the In Search of Darkness series. These are top quality. I mean, anyone that's got an interest in the genre, I've got every faith that this is going to be a really well-delivered and really beautifully put together documentary. Where can people get this from, and what's kind of the running time of it then in the end?
So we're doing it slightly different this time. So it is going to be like a 5-hour mega doc, and you certainly can watch it that way. However, this time it's going to be a series. It's going to be 5-hour long episodes. And the reason we're doing that is when people think horror gaming, they gravitate towards survival horror. And you could certainly do a 5-hour documentary on survival horror and not even scratch the surface. But one of our primary concerns was we didn't want to leave out any rich history that didn't fall within that parameter. Yeah. So, you know, like if you only focus on survival horror, you can't really talk about a lot of indie horror and all of those experimental titles. You can't really talk about something like Doom, which primarily is an FPS, yes, but is also one of the most important games of all time and was also designed as a horror game. It was designed to be scary. You know, you've got things like Castlevania that fall out of that remit, and you've got things like the FMV scene. So what we've done with this is we've structured it into these 5 episodes that take a specific topic and deep dive into that topic. We have a synopsis on the landing page, which is where you can also buy the documentary, and that is on terabytesdoc.com.
Well, I'll put the link in the show notes down so people can just click straight through check it out. And we had some great feedback when you were on last time, so I know there's been a lot of people hyped for this as well. So that's best of luck with it, and I hope you get some really nice feedback from people when they've got around to watching it.
Yeah, I can't wait for people to see it. We're very excited.
So if you do want to pre-order that, a massive love letter to Horror Games, Terabytes, the documentary. Filming starts on that very soon, so you can get yourself in the queue to get a copy of that. As soon as it lands, I'll link up the website in our show notes and all the rest of the stories at theretrohour.com. Now, we're going to be talking to Matthew from Amiga Kit, one of the world's longest-running Amiga retailers who's still doing Amiga as his full-time job, which is incredible. If we're talking about the Amiga, though, there is, you know, you think of the early days of the Amiga Revy. There is one title that for me is a real standout. And I, you know, from people we've spoken to, it was definitely a system seller in the earliest days of the Amiga. And that was Defender of the Crown. Were you a fan of that game?
Dun, 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 dun.
I thought you might be.
Oh, I absolutely love Defender of the Crown. Yeah. Kind of to the point that I seeked the Prime version, and that was a CDTV version.
Yes.
I remember that with a lot of the animated backgrounds. It was a great game, and, you know, any game where Robin Hood is involved in it, I'm always on that. But it was such an epic title with beautiful graphics done by Jim Sachs, and that really showed the kind of, you know, power of the Amiga back then. And it was all hand-drawn, and you know, I don't think there's a game that looks like it.
I must admit, you know, going back and playing it now, I think still graphically, it really holds up. I find some of the, you know, the jousting parts of it, I find the controls quite fiddly.
Yeah.
When I'm going back and playing it, some of the character movement and the, you know, the, obviously that was a very early game.
Well, it's always got those different sections, hasn't it? And there's different elements of gameplay in there, but it's that classic kind of medieval, you know, story with a love and romance. And just an absolutely beautiful title. And I love the pace of it as well.
Yeah, and it's got, you know, some beautiful lighting effects and stuff in there too. A real, you know, technical marvel when the Amiga first landed back in 1985. But the reason we're talking about this today is it's interesting that a Lithuanian company, this is a company called Nordcurrent. They're known for a title called Cooking Fever that I wasn't familiar with. But basically what they've done is they've now acquired the rights to the game lineup of Cinemaware. Because Cinemaware were around for a long time. I believe, didn't they have a bit of a revival?
Recently they actually released a really nice edition of Defender of the Crown, but also some other cinema titles. You know, It Came from the Desert was another fantastic kind of a B-movie title that they had out. And I think Red Baron might have been Cinemaware as well.
I know there were like some re-releases in recent years. I think they, from looking at their Wikipedia page, they basically went under in 1991. And then they had a bit of a comeback in 2000 to 2005 when their trademarks were acquired. And then there was stuff like, you know, there was Robin Hood, Defender of the Crown that came out on the Xbox in 2003. There was that reboot of Defender of the Crown, I think came out on the Game Boy Advance in around 2002. That's kind of an updated version of it. The digitally remastered collector's edition came out on Windows and Mac as well, where they updated the graphics and sound and everything as well. But basically there is a new company now, this Lithuanian developer, Nordcurrent, have now acquired the iconic titles from Cinemaware, including Defender of the Crown, It Came from the Desert, Wings as well. And the same
Wings,
what they're going to be doing.
That was it, not Red Baron. Well, I'd say Red Baron Wings.
I was going to say, I was checking
such
it out.
Such a big title, yeah.
Well, now Nordcurrent are basically saying that the reason they bought these is they want to remaster them and bring them back to modern platforms. And they're going to be starting with a remaster and an update of Defender of the Crown. So it's going to be coming back for modern systems.
It's really tough because I've looked at this Nordcurrent site and it looks like kind of flashy mobile.
Right.
Kind of, you know, like not amazingly well-styled stuff. And you're touching a classic there. You're touching an absolute classic and you're trying to redo it. And I honestly don't think they've got it in them. Sorry, it's really
say it like
harsh
it is,
Ravi.
Say it like it is.
But yeah, you know,
they might be listening now and be like, right, I'm going to show it. Right, we're going to do it.
We've hired Jim Sachs. We're going to show you.
I know what you're saying, though, because it is such an iconic title. It does kind of feel like, you know, messing with art in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it feels to me. And, you know, I don't know, Rocket Ranger, that was a good game, but it was always hard to play for me just to get him off the ground. Yeah. That might work well in mobile and stuff, but looking at their stuff, it looks like, you know, this Cooking Fever is kind of like a flashy, you know, paid more coins to get higher and stuff like that. So I think it's...
You're not wrong.
It might be they've just kind of, you know, bought the brands and they're going to ride off that a bit.
Well, it looks like, yeah, they are generally known for mobile games. That seems to be their kind of bread and butter. But it does say, I mean, you know, from the, obviously this is a press release, so it's obviously going to be a, you know, positive spin on things. It says that they are a growing player in the PC and console gaming industry. Interesting they managed to get their hands on the Cinemaware catalogue, though.
There must have been a deal done there.
I just kind of feel like, I mean, obviously these games are, you know, knocking on 40 years old now, and they've been, I imagine the rights have been through quite a few hands since the demise of Cinemaware in 1991. It makes you wonder kind of what the value is in these today. Because, I mean, obviously there will be a generation of us who fondly remember these games. But again, I think that makes it even more difficult, doesn't it, to kind of give these games the respect that they deserve.
Yeah, and like, you know, Streets of Rage and stuff, they changed the style and they brought some cool music in and they took a real different kind of direction. And, you know, that might happen, but I very much doubt it. Sorry, Nordcurrent.
Well, bearing in mind that Ravi is the guy that said the Nintendo Switch would be a massive failure.
Those are my predictions. Oh, yeah.
not that we bring that up very often on the
Nintendo
podcast.
Nintendo are dead. They're just gone. Yeah.
Long live Nordkorn.
Interesting to see that someone's doing something with the IPs, though. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on that. And as we hear more, we will let you know. Now, obviously, we're all big fans of the N64. Like I said, you know, been playing mine quite a bit this week. Enjoying having it set up. I think I'm going to leave my N64 set up permanently in my office now because I've had it away in my wardrobe for a couple of years. And I feel like that's a bit disrespectful to it because it's such a cool system, isn't it? And the games have definitely got a unique look. Now, there is a massive indie game called Celeste that many people will be familiar with. And it turns out that the creators of that game are obviously fans of the N64 as well, because the sequel to it not only looks very much like an N64 game, but it's even titled, not so subtly, Celeste 64.
Yeah, this is really cool. So it's a pseudo sequel. I you know what? I feel like Dan's usually the resident, like, I've never played this game. I've never played Celeste either.
Joe,
I know.
How can you not have played that?
I know. Ravi said it's fantastic, and I've been recommended it many, many times.
What is Celeste then, Ravi? I've not played this either.
It originally came out on the Pico 8. And, it's quite a popular indie game and done in a kind of... it's got interesting mechanics. So this was at a time when, mechanics were getting put into them. There was another one where you could rewind time. It also had stuff like mid-air dash, which was a big kind of move you could do in it. I only played in it very quickly, but it's very nice, and I know it was very popular, and it had a main protagonist as a young girl as well.
Yeah, I mean, the original looked like, you know, quite a nice pixel art kind of platformer game, pretty much. But this one is, it's got that N64 3D style.
Yeah, which is very in the vein of Mario 64, Banjo-Kazooie, Kong 64.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of got mental health elements in there as well, like panic attacks and stuff, and it's kind of like her world is interpreted on the game as well, so it's a different kind of mechanic. But I'm not sure how the follow-on for the N64 is gonna work and reflect that.
So it's not on the N64. It is available on PC.
Okay.
And it is completely for free. So this is actually a celebration of Celeste. So they've done this to celebrate the 6-year anniversary of Celeste, with Celeste 64 being created by the original developers as well, which are Maddie Forson and Noel Berry. And like I say, they've put this out completely for free over on itch.io, which is fantastic. I was watching a... playthrough of it earlier on, and it's not a short game. It looks about an hour to an hour and a half long, right, as well, which is nice. But what's really stunning about it, because of it does look like a, you know, an absolutely beautiful N64 game, you know, in all its polygon glory, what's absolutely fantastic about it is they made it in a week. It only took them a week to make this, and it, like I say, I haven't played Celeste, I've seen it, I've watched videos of it, and it really has captured the essence of that game. It looks like they've really captured kind of like, the only way I can describe it is from, you know, how we went from Super Mario World to Mario 64, and the elements of the game and the mechanics and everything transferred beautifully.
And that didn't always work. So, I mean, we remember, you know, famous examples like, you know, Bubsy 3D.
Yeah.
It was a tough thing to do back in the day, translate a 2D platformer into a 3D world.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looks like they've managed to do this. And as Ravi mentioned there, the famous kind of like air dash is present, and kind of like, I don't want to say puzzle platformer because it isn't really a puzzle platformer, but the elements of, you know, trying to figure out where you have to go and how to climb up and kind of kick off this wall and stuff like that, it's all completely present in this 64 version, in the 3D 64 version. One thing that I really love about it is obviously famously the N64 kind of like style games. Sometimes you might lose yourself, like if you're climbing up the side of a building or a mountain or something.
Cameras just, would go behind a mountain.
Cameras go home behind a mountain, stuff like that. In Celeste 64, when you are, you know, when the camera does that and it goes behind a building or a mountain or something, you are highlighted, kind of like you will still see the outline of Celeste, so you know where you are. Like if you're gripping to a wall.
If only the thought of that back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's a really cool little touch that they've put there. But yeah, you know, the fact that they've done it for free is awesome. And yeah, go check it out. This is making me going to go play normal Celeste and then go play Celeste 64. Yeah,
maybe this is one that we can do in the after hours and maybe we could do an indie game special or something.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Nice. Yeah, play some of these games that have, you know, just become massive legendary games in their own right from, you know, little indie devs.
It definitely feels like the direction that a lot of these kind of indie studios are going at. It feels like the 2D pixel art thing was, it was all the rage like a decade ago, but it does feel like now they're moving into that kind of PS1 N64 style 3D games, doesn't it? It feels like they've had a big comeback in the last like 18 months or so.
Sure.
Which I'm all for, you know. I think it's weird because for ages everyone was like, oh, you know, those early 3D games, oh, they look so janky now, no one's ever going to want to play those again. You know, the 2D games have aged so much better, but now there is nostalgia coming in for them.
Bring back the texture warping and stuff like that.
Yeah. Which appears in this as tearing and stuff, you know, and draw distance problems and, you know, which now is a feature, you know, not a limitation.
Feature so, screen tearing.
Yeah, exactly. on the feature list.
Unique. So, unique short draw distance.
Yeah, fog. Vaseline on your screen effect. So, yeah, very cool to see. So if you're a fan of Celeste and you want to play a new spin on that, taking it into the world of 3D, that is available now. And I'll put that. And, of course, the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job. Just check your show notes on your podcast app or head to the website at theretrohour.com. Right, patrons, stand by. We have got a few more new stories just for you coming up in just a moment, because if you join us on Patreon, that is one of the perks that you get. You get the normal podcast ad-free every week. You also get an extra like 10, 15 minutes of news that we do just for our patrons. And I try and get the podcast out early if I can some weeks as well. And plenty more perks, including access to our bonus podcast, The After Hours, if you join us as a gold member or above, and an invite to the monthly patrons hangouts that are coming up at the end of the month as well. So all the details to join us on Patreon are on the website right now at theretrohour.com. We'd really appreciate your support. Okay, before we chat to this week's special guest, Matthew Lehman from Amiga Kit, let's take a quick second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and it is a regular sponsor of the Retro Hour podcast. This is our wonderful friends at ExpressVPN. Now, have you guys checked your streaming platform bills recently? It seems like every time I check my bank statements, it seems like Netflix has crept up by another couple of quid. And
They convince us to cut the cord and then they increase everything and they go, ha ha, you've cut the cord. We're going to charge you more.
So insane. I think about the amount of services we've got. I mean, you know, I think I've mentioned this before. We do, got Netflix and obviously I've got a 4K TV, so I've got to get the premium package of that, which I've got a feeling is like, I think it might be about 18 quid a month, maybe even more now. We've got Disney Plus, you know, my missus watches that all the time, Amazon Prime, Paramount
Plus. YouTube Premium,
Yeah, YouTube Premium I've got as well. I mean, there are so many of these services. And the problem is, I mean, you don't mind paying for a service if you're getting value from it. But did you know that, for example, talking about Netflix, you're paying, you know, all this money out every month, but you're literally getting access to a fraction of their library. Because in different countries around the world, Netflix has got thousands of shows that you probably can't watch in your country without using a VPN. Because, you know, of course, there's the licensing rules and all that. They often only license shows based on a location.
Or they swap around as well. So sometimes some will be available on one service, disappear, and then turn up in another country and then come back. And, you know, it's hard to track and find your favorite shows.
It is. And sometimes you might, you know, I don't know about you, I open Netflix sometimes and go through it. You know, I think they call it doom scrolling, don't they? Well, you know, there's a load of stuff on that. But you're like, seen that. Anything I want to watch, I've kind of seen this month. But then if you have ExpressVPN on your device, you can literally just press a little button and change your online location. So then suddenly Netflix thinks, oh, okay, this guy's in America. Let's show him all the titles that are available on the American Netflix library that normally you can't see in the UK, which I know you do all the time, Ravi. You're always telling us about things that you watch on the US Netflix that we get very jealous that we haven't watched.
Yeah, well, one of them recently that I've been watching on the US Netflix is Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
And, classic.
That is That is a show that, you know, to be honest, you watch it and you can't believe that it's actually been aired. Some of the stuff on that are absolutely hilarious. And another one that I know Dan's absolute favourite film, you know, he models himself on a lot of these people, Mean Girls.
Yeah, A Weapon on Thursdays, I think it is.
Yeah. USA.
So Fetch.
Yeah, So Fetch. Don't make Fetch happen, Dan. And Lord of the Rings as well. And they're both on the Australian Netflix. So, you know, moving around to different countries is absolutely great because you can find new content on there, and also Muriel's Wedding as well, which is another great chick flick.
Yes, that's the thing. I mean, it is literally, I mean, it's so easy as well, isn't it? You open the app, you select the country name, you tap one button and you're there.
Yeah, it's so fast that sometimes I have it starting up on my computer and I forget about it. And I'm like, oh, suddenly my location is in this country, you know.
Yeah, streaming HD, you know, no buffering. There's apps available for all your devices, your phone, your laptop, your consoles, your smart TVs, and install it directly on there as well. And they've got servers in 94 different countries around the world. So again, access to thousands of new shows. And it doesn't just work with Netflix, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, lots more as well. So be smart with your money. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. ExpressVPN, it pays for itself. So get your money's worth. Use our exclusive link as well and you will get an amazing offer, because you know we all sort one out for you. You'll get 3 months of ExpressVPN for free on top of a 12-month plan. So head to expressvpn.com/retro. Use our exclusive link. Really helps out the podcast. It lets them know that we sent you there, and get that 3 months for free on top of a 12-month plan. expressvpn.com/retro. And a massive thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their continued support. Right, then next, we're going to be going inside the world of Amiga Kit, one of the world's longest running Amiga retailers, and finding out all about this really interesting new device they've got coming out called the A600GS, geared towards people who use their Amiga for applications and productivity back in the day. We're going to be chatting to Matthew from Amiga Kit next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And you'll know from listening to previous episodes that Ravi and I, we don't need any excuse to talk about the Commodore Amiga, our favourite machine. And we regularly keep you up to date on all the exciting developments in the world of Amiga. And, you know, if we're talking about stuff that's happening on the Amiga scene in 2024... one company that's really helped to keep the scene alive over the last couple of decades is Amiga Kit. Now, they're a company who specialise in providing hardware, software, accessories, all kinds of things for the Amiga in all its wonderful, wonderful guises. And we thought we'd welcome on the Managing Director of Amiga Kit to tell us a bit about what they're doing and kind of the Amiga scene in 2024, and also their exciting new product, the A600GS. That is set to launch a bit later on this year. So let's welcome on the MD of Amiga Kit, Matthew Lehman. How's it going, Matthew?
Hello, Dan. Hello, Ravi. It's great to be with you today. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to join you.
Yeah, it's always nice to talk to you. And I mean, bizarrely, I mean, obviously we've met so many times at Amiga events all around Europe. You know, it's pretty shocking we haven't had you on the podcast until now. So it is, it's wonderful that you took the time to come on and share a bit about your history and also what's going on right now with Amiga Kit, because I speak as someone who's been a customer of Amiga Kit and think, God, it must be knocking on. How long have you been around now? It must be nearly 20 years, is it?
Well, yeah, this year actually is our 20th anniversary. So. Right. Yeah, we're
very, very timely to get you on then.
Yes, and it's great. It's great to meet you over the many, many years in lots of shows that we've been to, and like you said, you've been a customer. Ravi's been a customer as well. So
Well,
it's interesting to kind of, I don't think one thing I've never asked you about before, but it's always interesting to find out a bit of history on our guests. I mean, you know, what initially got you into the wonderful world of computers then? Where did kind of your journey begin as a kid then? What was your first machine? What happened?
Well, my dad brought home an Acorn Atom back in the 80s, about 1984, something like that. And I thought, what is this strange computer that he's brought home? And I started programming on it, and it wasn't the best experience. And shortly after that, I suppose that whet his appetite to buy a proper computer, and he bought a Commodore Plus 4, which he brought home with all the accessories. You know, do you remember the printer, the old noisy NPS 801, I think it was called.
Yeah, I've got one of those still to this day.
You've still got one, yeah. Yeah. And the disk drive, the 5 1/4-inch disk drive. So he had this. I think at the time they were putting it on as a promotion, and so it was a good deal that he got it all together. And he said to me, "Your computers are the future," because remember in the early 1980s, they were very, very geeky. Not many people had a home computer, and he encouraged me to start programming and to look into these machines. So I looked into it, and I started playing some of the games that you got with the Plus 4. Do you remember some of the favorites, like Fire Ant and Treasure Island?
Yeah.
And
Icicle Works.
Yeah, we've had a lot of
Plus 4 talk. Icicle Works was great, yeah.
We've had a lot of Plus 4 talk because I know that was Dan's first system as well.
Oh, yes.
You both kind of share that.
Yeah. It's bizarre because, you know, to me as a kid, obviously in that pre-internet era, I knew a few kids who kind of got the Plus 4 in that, you know, they were doing that fire sale to sell them off cheap. But that's recently on the podcast, it seems like every other person we've had on is like, oh, yeah, I started with the Plus 4. And as much as it gets derided, I think that machine, you know, for me, that introduced me to the world of computers. So as much as people kind of, you know, poke fun at that machine for not being as successful as a 64, it definitely had its place in history, I think, in terms of starting people in the industry and getting them interested in computers.
Yes, and it was very easy to pick up because the BASIC was better than the BASIC that you got with the Commodore 64. So it was a bit more accessible. You could do a bit more with it. So you didn't have to remember so many pokes and peek commands that you did with the Commodore 64. And it was a shame that Commodore didn't give it a bit more memory, and it didn't have a SID chip and all that sort of stuff. But it could have been a nice little upgrade on the 64. But Commodore, in the infinite wisdom, took memory away and decided to downgrade the sound on it. So it wasn't quite the potential it should have been, and that's why they had a fire sale on it, of course, to clear the stocks of it. So that's where I started off, but. I thought I'd get my own computer. So my dad made me save up my pocket money, it seemed, for endless months. And I eventually bought a Commodore C64C then. And I was very close to saving the full amount. And my dad then stepped in at the last minute and paid the balance. So I had this shiny new Commodore C64C for the summer holidays. And then my Commodore experience continued from there. You know, there were some great games on the C64. Do you remember the flight game Ace, which had synthesized speech on it? And
that was jaw dropping when I first heard that.
At the time, it was like, "Whoa, you got speech!" There was lots of nice Sean Southern games on there as well. Trailblazer, do you remember that? And Aztec Challenge, that was another good game I used to like playing on the C64. But I enjoyed using that machine. But then my friend, his brother, who had a job at the time and he could afford all these things, he decided to get an Amiga 500. And I remember going around my friend's house, and he said, "Oh, come and see what my brother's got upstairs." So we went upstairs to his room, and that was my first taste of the Amiga, Amiga 500. And he showed me Barbarian at the time, and well, you know, the 10-star pack that you got with it, with all these games. Mm. And it was just such a step up from the 8-bits, the graphics, the sound, the way it almost, at the time, it seemed like it instantly loaded, but of course it didn't. But compared with the old tapes on my Commodore 64, it was like night and day. But that was a real sea change then, seeing what the 16 bits could do. You could see the potential of the 16-bit. It was so strange. You switch it on with the Commodore 64, with the Plus 4, you see the BASICs prompt. That's the first thing that you see on the screen. With the Amiga, there was nothing like that. It just said, "Insert a disc," and you're like,
"Yeah."
Whoa.
And that freaked me out when I got my Amiga 500. I'm like, "Yo, there must be some." I was hitting the keyboard like, you know, "Yeah, where's the prompt? There's got to be something in there." But obviously, you had to load software first. It was very different.
And I guess when you got the Amiga as well, there was still quite a bit of choice out there as well. What really made the Amiga stand out then and make you kind of choose it?
Actually, the same friend. We went round mutual friends, and he had an Atari. So we were still on the 8-bits at this time, and I had a taste for the Atari, and it looked quite elegant because it's a bit more futuristic than the 8-bits, and the graphics were better, and you could that was probably one of the first interactions that I had with the 16-bit machines. But it wasn't really like the Amiga. It didn't have the creative feel that the Amiga had, you know? And I think the Amiga in... that was one of the things that the Amiga did. It had a strong community around it, even in those days. Mostly there was people swapping discs and things like that. There was copy parties, but there was a lot of people at home firing up DevPack and playing with assembly, trying to make their own games, using Octomed to make some composition, Deluxe Paint to be creative, and the Amiga was more than the game system because of that. And that whole scene was quite, when you're a teenager and you see what your friends are doing creatively on a computer and not just playing games, that was quite quite a draw to the Amiga over other systems that were out there.
I think a lot of the kind of general public forget about the creative side with the Amiga and stuff. And I was wondering, what setup did you have? Did you have any like extras with it or any kind of devices you were using to help your creativity?
I think the number one, I'm not sure about you, but you probably were the same as me. The number one upgrade on my Amiga that's really I couldn't do without would be the hard drive. When you've got a floppy disk Amiga and you go to a hard disk Amiga, oh, wow, it's a different world. And I remember buying my first hard disk. It was a 60 megabyte hard drive, and it cost a fortune at the time.
Yeah, I remember we got a 30 meg one, and it was just like mind-blowingly expensive.
Mine was 20 megabytes, and I thought that was an infinite amount. Yes. I'm never going to fill all. And then I installed Monkey Island 2. Half of it wiped out with one game.
Yes, of course. My friend had a 20 megabyte drive, and I just waited because I couldn't afford a hard drive at the time, you know, being a poor teenager. And I could see that he had everything on there, but he used some sort of compression. Do you remember the compressors that you could... they would dynamically compress your hard drive
Packer, I remember, was one.
It was a bit like Power Packer, but every time you copied to your hard drive, it would double the space on your hard drive. So it was like dynamic compression, but it would slow down your Amiga. And he had mods on there and things like that. So his 20 meg hard drive, he could push the limits on it. So I waited and waited. I was glad I waited in the end. And I remember 60 meg coming out and thinking, well, I'll pay the extra for these 60 meg hard drives. And I think there was a company, do you remember Gasteiner in London?
Yes.
Yeah, I think they had the best price on the 60 meg hard drive. So I decided to put my money down, and it came in the post, and I installed it. And, well, I never looked back after that. But that was just the start of the journey, because then I needed extra memory, I needed an accelerator, and that was the great thing about the Amiga. You could build on it and extend it. So it was really extensible machine because of that.
One thing I always found as well is in that era, you know, before we were all connected to the internet, or even, you know, before I got involved in bulletin boards and that kind of thing, I mean, the central thing to the Amiga community was the magazines. So, yes. I mean, did you have any favourite magazines that you'd pick up like every issue?
Well, I was probably like, I think most Amiga enthusiasts, I bought every single magazine, you know, throughout the month. You go into your W.H. Smith's or John Menzies, and you see the principal one I'd always go for would be Amiga Format. And then it got a bit addictive. So you buy Amiga Shopper, and you buy CU Amiga, which was great. Amiga User International. The ones I didn't buy was things like the Amiga Power and The One. Do you remember The One magazine?
Yeah, dedicated games mags then, weren't they?
I liked games, but I liked quite a balance of things in the magazine. So, you know, if I was really desperate, I'd buy those. But for my Amiga fix, if I ran out of my Amiga fix in that month. But
did you live off cover discs as well?
I think we all did, didn't we? Yeah.
Any favourites that spring to mind, like cover discs from back in the day?
Oh, well, the best cover discs, I think, Amiga Computing cover discs. I don't know if you ever saw those. They had a game on there. They had Tune of the Month. They had a development source code of the month. So there was a whole array of stuff that they fitted on this one small cover disc. It was extraordinary. And it would always link to an article in the actual magazine. So you could get the cover disc and go to the development section of the magazine, and all the examples will be on the cover disc, or it would have the tune of the month or the latest demo, you know, the latest games demo, so you could see what was coming out. It was great. But later on, I'm sure you remember CU Amiga and Amiga Format, they decided to go to CD editions of the cover discs. And that was pre-internet. That was so useful, because then suddenly they would have to fill 660 meg of data. They felt obligated to fill 660 meg. So they obviously went to all these BBSs and internet sites and things like that in the early days, and downloaded as Usenet and all this sort of stuff, and downloaded as much data as they could. So for us who were offline, you know, accessing all this data every month, you could see what everyone else was doing around the world with the Amiga. So that was a really nice time for the Amiga, I think. A very exciting time to see. We were almost connected with the CDs, you know, because we had we could see what other people were creating, PD games and tunes and all this sort of stuff. It was a great time.
Did you ever go to any of the big shows? I think you're a bit older than me. When I went, I was about 12 years old, and kind of with my dad, you know, but they were still really exciting.
Yeah, I did. I remember traveling down to London, and did you go to the Hammersmith show? And
I think I went to the last World of Amiga, which was at the Novotel.
That's
like a distant memory from when I was younger.
I went to a couple of World of Amigas, and this was obviously after Commodore had filed for bankruptcy, and Petro was trying to rejuvenate the Amiga. So
there were a few dance acts around.
Stuff like that,
I remember, yeah.
The Annex dances and stuff like that. So we were all hoping, dearly hoping, that the Amiga could come back for the future, as the catchphrase was. And we were hoping, because at the time, do you remember ESCOM? They brought out brand new Amiga 1200s in their shops, in their PC shops. You could actually walk into an ESCOM shop.
So they bought out the Amiga, didn't they? And we had, I think we had 3 ESCOM stores in Nottingham or 2.
Yeah.
And but we could barely find the Amigas in them. I think at one point they were displaying them in the window, but they just had the Kickstart screen running continually.
Yeah, because they didn't know what to do with it. I remember evangelizing to my wife's uncle, because he was umming and ahhing over getting a multimedia PC or an Amiga. And he was an Amiga guy before, so he had an Amiga 500. And we went into an ESCOM shop, and I managed to get him to buy a Magic Pack as they were selling it. And, he then, of course, had to embark on... He needs a hard drive, and he needs an accelerator, and all these sort of stuff. So he came with us to the shows at Hammersmith, and there was quite a few retailers around these shows, and you could walk around, and it was brilliant. Every single stall had something exciting to buy for your Amiga, and we managed to pick up, and there was some good bargains. We had managed to pick him up a RAM cars and and an accelerator.
So at the time that Commodore collapsed, there was a huge kind of scene still around the Amiga. And kind of, ESCOM had it for a while and they started doing plans, but it kind of fell on the third-party retailers. Do you remember any kind of big companies at the time? And they ended up kind of taking on the user base, didn't they?
Yeah, because you walk around these shows and there was Gas Diner, like I mentioned earlier. Power Computing, they were really good. I ordered a lot from Power Computing back in the late 90s and early 2000s. There was iTech as well.
Golden Valley Products?
Golden Image.
GVP.
GVP. I think GVP's distributor in the UK was Power Computing. Okay. I think people like Blittersoft, you remember Blittersoft? So, Weird Science. The UK was a hotbed for great retailers and innovation. And you get fantastic products back in the day, like the Squirrel SCSI, and obviously Phase 5 was selling some really great accelerators for your
Amiga. It was quite a long period of time, but just putting this in context for listeners that might know about that period, which is probably quite a few actually, the whole idea was people were trying to keep the Amiga alive and the hope, and stuff like magazines were still selling on the shelves really well. Even though Commodore and ESCOM had kind of, you know, collapsed and gone away, all these people remained and they had like future plans as well. They were trying to put in future technology. And one company that I remember, especially being in the UK, was iTech as well. What was the kind of your history with iTech, and do you remember them bringing out products and stuff like that?
So iTech, going from, so after the World of Amiga shows in Hammersmith, the Amiga got quite small towards 2000, 2001. And there was a small magazine open called Total Amiga, and they decided to put on a smaller version of the World of Amiga. And iTech were the principal retailer to this show. It was called World of Amiga Southeast. And iTech was showing, previously they had always done Amiga classic upgrades, but now they were venturing into the next generation Amiga hardware. And they had partnered with a company called Essena in Germany, and they were making this Amiga One product, which was a new motherboard, a next generation Amiga motherboard. It seemed a very ambitious project. I remember going to this smaller cut down Amiga show in the World of Amiga in Southeast, and they had the early prototype Amiga One there, and they were, and Alan Redhouse, who ran iTech, he was explaining to everyone about the hardware and where it was going, and Amiga OS was progressing from the classic Amiga OS to this new generation Amiga OS 4. So that I don't think at the time they had it fully running on this board, and there were some issues. But it seemed like there was a new dawn to the Amiga coming.
So you guys ended up, once iTech kind of collapsed, they were searching for this new architecture and this new kind of speed. You guys ended up buying a lot of their stock, I guess, and then forming Amiga Kit.
Yes. Well, we were already formed in 2004, but I think the Amiga One project, iTech had lots of problems with it because it was very ambitious, like I said. And I think, I don't know for certain, but I think all these problems, you know, they were too much hassle for them to carry on. And so at the time, 2004, the Amiga was 2005. The Amiga was in serious decline. People were putting Amigas in skips. You know, they weren't. I remember Amigas on eBay going for about £20.
I literally was walking my dog with my friend and turned around and there was a stack of Amigas on the floor and games, you know, and we just picked them up straight away. But I also remember at that time, Amiga Kit was probably one of the only places that you could order from and get any kind of new upgrades or adapters.
Absolutely. Well, this was the problem, you know. People like Power Computing were closing. I think they were the last ones to close. And then iTech had sort of gone into hibernation. It wasn't clear whether from their website whether they were still working in the Amiga market. So that was the catalyst to set up Amiga Kit, because I thought, right, we need something in the UK. We need a retailer, at least one retailer, you know, in the UK. And it was quite dark times at the time. And no one else was serving the market. So Amiga Kit was set up, and we continued with the project from there. And so we thought, right, what new products can we make? How can we get into the market? And then I had contact from Alan Redhouse, who ran iTech, and he initially made contact and he said, do you want to buy some of my stock, you know? So it was a small collection of the stock for X. So we negotiated a value for it. So that was all done and dusted. And then he contacted me again, do you want to buy a bit more? And then a bit more. And we had quite a few conversations. And by the end of it, I was buying basically all his remaining stock, his residual stock. The final thing was that I had to, which was quite sad, I had to go up to his warehouse up in Stokesley, I think it was, so not far from Middlesbrough. So I travelled up there and I had to take the final bits of stock out of his warehouse and hand the keys to his landlord because he had finished the business. So that was quite poignant and quite sad to see that chapter of iTech close. But we ended up with huge amounts of iTech stock in the end, and we had to warehouse it, and in fact some of the stocks even to this day we've still got in our warehouse.
You know, for me as someone who I was into the Amiga, you know, real hardcore Amiga fan until around 2001. And then I think, you know, I'd gone away to university at that point. You know, I ended up, Windows XP came out and that was kind of usable, you know, it kind of felt not too far away from the Amiga. You know, actually got rid of my Amigas at the time. And then I saw an eBay listing a few years later, got an Amiga 600, then a 1200, ended up getting back into it. And it was really around 2007 that I re-entered the Amiga scene. And that's when I became aware of Amiga Kit, because, you know, when I dropped off in 01, like you said, it was, you know, iTech were kind of the big player. Yeah. And the fact that, you know, you guys are still here 20 years later, you know, and you are, you know, a full-time Amiga retailer, people will be like, really?
Yes.
These people are doing this as a full-time business. So give us a bit about kind of your setup at Amiga Kit then. How many staff do you have, and how do you maintain running an Amiga business full-time in 2024?
It isn't easy. It isn't easy, unfortunately. We've got four members of staff in the UK, and most of them are based in Cardiff. I'm not based in Cardiff anymore, but it isn't that easy to service the Amiga community. And for the last 20 years, we've had some really good times and some years where it's been difficult to be a full-time Amiga retailer. But we've always stuck to our principles, and we haven't ventured outside the Amiga market. So we've always tried to service the Amiga market as best we can. And we're very reliant on our loyal customer base, you know, like yourself and many other people. We've had customers for many, many years, and they've come back. So that's always been great. We've met them at shows. Putting a name to face is great. And without our customer base, we wouldn't be able to survive. So we're very grateful for that.
It's really impressive, actually, because I do remember there were a few companies like Visalia, which has actually gone recently.
And, sad.
Analogic and stuff that were back from the old days. And, of course, Steve Jones returning with his Checkmate, which, you know, kind of warms the heart to see some of these old brands and names, you know.
It's great. It's great to see. Oh, it's very sad about Visalia because Guido was He was a fantastic retailer. He did a lot of good stuff for the Amiga market. He sponsored a lot of hardware projects as well. So he wasn't just a retailer. You know, he made things happen, which was to the benefit of the entire community. And obviously he's closed recently, and he's hopefully he'll have a great retirement. But like you said, it's fantastic to see long-standing names in the Amiga community still contributing back to our space. So may it continue.
Well, talking of hardware as well, you know, you've got your own device coming out, and we've had a Palion on with the 2600. We've had a Vampire who were previously on. We've had Retro Games Limited. We've had quite a lot of companies that have released devices, Spectrum Next as well, and you guys are coming with the A600GS. So could you tell us, what is the A600GS?
The A600GS is a low-cost device that can access classic Amiga applications and games. So the idea is very similar to a lot of these mini boxes that you've got out there. You can plug it conveniently into your HDMI television, play games, but also access applications. I remember what we were saying earlier about the Amiga was different from other systems because it wasn't just a games platform.
There was a serious side, you know.
Yeah, creative side, and that's what makes the Amiga wonderful and the community wonderful, is because they are so creative. So what we've decided to do is put some famous Amiga applications on, pre-installed on the A600GS. One of them, obviously, is very, very well known, is the Octomed package. And there's been lots of notable songs, music in the past that's been created with Octomed. But we're also putting things like P-Paint, Personal Paint, on there, because we know that apart from playing games, ex-Amiga users and Amiga users in the community, they love the creative side of the Amiga, and why not have these preloaded up on the A600GS so you can enjoy them? We've got the source code, so we've decided not just to take the Octomed or take the old P-Paint, but it's been redeveloped. So new features being added. We've listened to our customers and what they want to see on these famous packages. And these new features will be in the new versions of Octomed, P-Paint, and that will be ready to go when we launch the game system.
Because yeah, I've been looking at some of that. I remember you were at Ravi's Kickstarter event last year as well. There's a prototype there, and also you've got a website set up, and I know you've put some images on social media. So to describe to people, this is basically it's a very small device, about looks like the size of a deck of cards, really. Small little black box with the branding on there as well. I mean, obviously, there's been talk about this on the Amiga social media pages and forums. So some people have kind of said, is this like a Raspberry Pi in there running custom software? We've heard that it's ARM-based. I mean, can you tell us the difference between this and a Raspberry Pi, and what hardware is it based on? Is there like custom hardware in here? What is it exactly?
Yeah, so it's the prototype that you saw in Ravi's Kickstarter event last year. That was in a much smaller box. What we've done now is put it in a slightly larger box. It's it has got now 2 9-pin Amiga joystick / mouse ports on there, so you can plug in your legacy controllers into it. Nice. So that's on the front, and on the back, then you've got things like USB, HDMI, audio out, but it's also got Bluetooth and network capability. A lot of the mini boxes don't have internet connectivity or Bluetooth. So it's got an ARM SoC in it, pretty much everything these days has. And that's the cheapest way of, because this has got to be a low price point. And the ARMs are pretty good. They're fast, 4 gig of memory is on that. So there's plenty of memory for running your apps and, of course, your games and things like that. We're going to put 128 gig storage in that. So that should be enough, I think, for most people to store all their games and their applications. Plus, we've divided the disk up. So you've got your work area where you can create your own pictures. You can create stuff in Octomed. You can save all your creations to that. Then you've got USBs on the back, so you can plug in a flash drive and download all your stuff.
Do you have a USB-C as well?
It's USB-C to power it. So,
nice.
Yeah, that's the other great thing about ARMs, isn't it? They don't need a lot of power, so it can be powered up with USB-C. I think it offers everything that a classic Amiga fan would want in a small package without breaking the bank. And it might be a discretionary purchase for somebody who remembers the Amiga and decides, I want to resume my creativity with Octomed that I did 10 years ago, you know. One of the problems is buying a classic Amiga is really difficult these days because the price has just gone through the roof. And then you're buying a computer which is essentially 30 years old. How do you know about reliability? And then the third problem is that to play with Octomed, you need extra memory, you need probably a hard disk, and all this sort of all these extra things, they just soon add up. So we're trying to make it really accessible for users to just grab this small box, plug it into their HDMI monitor or television. It comes with a mouse, comes with a joypad. You can hook up a USB keyboard if you want, and just start enjoying your old nostalgia on P-Paint and Octomed. We've got our AmiBench on there, which AmiBench is your desktop environment, and it should be instantly familiar to anyone who remembers the Amiga. So we're hoping it's going to be a good experience for people.
Yeah, and I was also wondering what the kind of relationship with developing it with Rabbit Hole Computing was as well, because they're the folks behind the Zulu SCSI and the SCSI 2SD devices, which are really popular.
Well, Alex is a very good friend of mine. He's the brains behind Rabbit Hole Computing, which, like you said, creates Zulu. And do you remember the SCSI 2SD, which preceded it? He's always got ideas, hardware ideas, and he's always throwing things at me about this product. So he was one of the he used his internal in-house developer to lay out the board and help us with the hardware side of things, and so we're very grateful for that. They're part of the beta test and development team. So it's a very collaborative product, you know?
Yeah, one thing I was wondering as well is, obviously in the 21st century now, all devices are internet connected. And I've seen that the A600GS, you've got, remote updates on there. You've also got something called the AMI store as well, which I'm guessing is kind of like your version of like the app store. Is that, how's that going to function? How does that work?
Yeah, so we, as you probably know, we're involved with the next generation system. So on the X5000, the X1000, AMI Store was created for the next generation Amiga One systems. Now that's fine because that App Store can run on those because they had internet connectivity out the box, and the App Store is quite graphic intensive, you know, because it looks like an App Store that you would find on more modern hardware. Now, the problem is when you've got a classic Amiga, how do you do that? Because you need the extra memory, you need the internet connectivity. So we saw an opportunity with the A600GS. You've got plenty of memory. It can run full 1080p, 32-bit screens on AmiBench on the desktop. AmiStore suddenly became viable to run on this hardware. And Aeon, who owns Octomed, owns PPaint, they have a library of other classic Amiga applications, which would be of interest to a lot of the Amiga community. So having this AmiStore system, which works, has been running for the last 5 years on the next generation machines, also on the A600GS, can make sense. And users then can download 68K classic Amiga applications that have been updated. But also we want to support there's a lot of new developers who are making new classic games for the Amiga. Mm. So we want to really support those guys and encourage those guys to show their work to the wider community. Recently, I went to Amiga Island and Nifri Games. He's produced some wonderful new stuff. But unless you're on Twitch or some of the other social platforms, you'll never hear about them. So we're hoping that the A600GS will be a way of showcasing some of this new talent and some of these new games which are coming out for the classic Amiga.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to have games on there as well. And I was wondering how they load as well, because I know WHD load was a very popular way to kind of load images back in the days as well, especially when they didn't have hard drive installs. What kind of options do you have for games on there as well, and like saving states and stuff like that?
Well, the most basic way of doing it is through ADFs. So the A600GS has got a full games menu, and you can just use your USB, just plug into the back of the A600GS, select the ADF that you want, configure it for the platform you want, because some Amiga discs, some Amiga games, they only work on like the legacy, like the Amiga 500 or the Amiga 600 specs.
They can be a bit fussy, can't they?
They can indeed, unfortunately. So you can select very quickly, edit the title, select the platform it was aimed at, then press start, and then the game will run according to that platform. We did find that quite a few games as well that we could make a hard drive, like a little mini hard drive environment, and put games into those. When we went to, because we approached the WHD load author, and when we went to offer in some sort of licensing, are asking for licensing for the A600GS, unfortunately, he is. Has an exclusive deal with some other company, so we couldn't use WHD load. So we looked at other options like JST. Do you remember the JST system?
That's like a way of loading, basically running floppy disks games on a hard disk, isn't it? So you don't have to keep swapping disks and everything. Yeah,
yeah, and it's also compatible with WHD load. A lot of the slaves are compatible with WHD load, So we looked at that system as well. So we're looking at incorporating that into the system, hopefully we can help make JST even more popular than it is. I remember way before WHD loads, back 12, 15 years ago, we used to use JST for everything. You know, that was the default thing, and then WHD load came along and had JST support, and recently JST has been redeveloped and it's got WHD load support. So it seems like a good system to have, rather than have the WHD load.
Will it be easy for users to put their own games onto the system?
Yes. So you can do it two ways. So like I described, you've got the games menu. So as soon as you switch it on, you can go into the games menu, and you've got pictures of floppy disks, and you can put in a USB flash drive. You can download your game as an ADF, and then it will be stored in your system, and you can configure it as you want, or to the best the best optimized way to run it on the A600GS. And that those settings will be always saved, and you can press start and it will start straight away. The other way of doing it is we've got AmiBench, which is the system that's the desktop system that's actually on the A600GS. You could go into AmiBench and you've got a work partition, and you can save whatever you like in there. You could put loads of games in there if you want, and run them with WHD load if you own WHD load, or if you want to use JST, you could use JST. So it's up to you. The flexibility is there, and there are games packs that I've seen around that you can, if the user wants to do that, they can do it from
unofficial USB sources.
I saw you did a talk and you mentioned Bluetooth audio, and that sounds really interesting. So can you like separately send the audio to like a soundbar or to Bluetooth headphones? Oh, that's great, because some complex setups you have to go through your TV and all of this kind of stuff, but if you could pick it up as just a Bluetooth audio device.
Yeah, it's quite straightforward, because you've got audio settings, audio preferences, as we call it. You click on that, or you use your joypad to navigate down to it. You click on scan for Bluetooth devices, and it will scan the vicinity for and it'll bring up a list of all the Bluetooth devices. So you click pair next to the device that you want to access. Make sure the speaker is in pairing mode as well, and then they'll just join, and then you just you direct all the sounds to the Bluetooth device. You can select the volume as well remotely on the A600GS, and away to go. I tried it with Bluetooth headphones the other day. My daughter had some Bluetooth headphones for Christmas, so I thought, well, I'm going to just try those and see if it works, and it worked fine with those as well. So
it's good if you're playing on it in the living room or
something. Yeah. 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 Cause if the wife says, what is that terrible retro music?
Yeah, it's an acquired taste to some people, isn't it? I know, yeah. Well, Matthew, I think it sounds a really interesting project. And I mean, from it, that's the thing. I mean, the stuff like the A500 Mini out there that are really targeted towards, retro games players. Mm-hmm. And I think, the first thing I did when I got my hands on the A500 Mini is, basically try and hack it and get Workbench running on there and applications and stuff. So, and like you said, the Amiga was such a creative machine, and I've got a lot of similar memories to you, spending loads of times in applications and exploring those cover CDs. And I think for fans of that side of the Amiga, this does sound like a really nice solution where they're not going to have to try and, force a way to get applications installed on it that weren't meant to run on it.
Yeah.
In terms of, basically where it fits in the market, and I appreciate, you might not have all these details tied down yet, any kind of idea on rough kind of release date or rough pricing, what it's going to cost?
Yeah, the price is going to be £100 plus VAT, which is about £120.
Reasonable.
And that will come with, so you will get your the latest version of PPaint pre-installed, which is 7.4. You get Octomed, which is version 8, which we've gone to the 1996 source code and continued development on that. And you get AmiBench on there pre-set up, so you don't, no messing around. AmiBench is on there. We've commissioned a nice icon set, so it looks really nice. 32-bit AmiBench background, with some nice backgrounds and things. It won't come with AmiStore straight out of the box, so we're releasing it, and then a couple of months later, we will push AmiStore out. But we just want to tweak that and get that exactly right. But it will have on the next generation Amigas, we've got a program called Updater, which works on Workbench and looks for all the Amiga files that it needs to update. And Updater will be on this system as well. So it will connect to the server that AmiStore runs on, which is called the AmiSphere, and download updates in real time for the users. So they don't need to worry about setting up all your desktop environment, your AmiBench environment, worry about files being up to date, because we'll just push them down, periodically as we develop new versions of the files. So we're trying to make it as easy as possible and so people don't have to tinker under the engine, you know, and get this optimal system. And the thing is with AmuBench is it's all based on our own software that we've developed over many years. It's a cohesive environment, and that's what we're trying to make it as easy as possible for the end user.
Yeah, and I know you've got a website, a600gs.com. Is that the best place for people to go to get updates?
Yes. If you go to a600gs.com, it's a holding page at the moment, but we are taking emails from customers who are potential customers who are interested in the system. If you go up to the top, there's a row of four icons. You can click on the wiki icon, and it will give you all the fine detail about the machine. How to use the software and all that sort of stuff. And every week or so, we're updating the wiki, so it is getting bigger and bigger. And we're hoping that's going to be the definitive resource for the machine. So people can go there, they can see exactly all the different facets of the computer. Hopefully that will be the one-stop shop for it. But a600gs.com is the official website, yes.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, even, you know, someone like me who I'm looking over at my 060-based Amiga 1200 next to me, I've got an A4000. I'm still excited to get my hands on this because, you know, you just can't have too much Amiga in your life, I don't think. So
No.
Yeah, more options is always a good thing. So, wish you all the best with it, Matthew. And obviously, I imagine we're going to see you at events. Have you got plenty lined up for the summer already?
We have, yes. I'm very excited to visit Ravi's event for the second time. So we went last year to the inaugural Kickstart event in Nottingham, and this year we'll be there again.
Plenty of beers will be flowing, for sure.
Well, that's always a good thing. You got me there. So. And before then, we got a show in London just before that, and no Amiga 30 and no Amiga 39 this year in Germany, sadly. So that's usually one on our calendar, but we will be at AMI West then in October, and anything else that pops up. We've just been to Amiga Ireland showing the A600GS there. So anything else that pops up, if we can support people with their shows or their meets, that we're more than happy to support or sponsor shows, you know, to keep the scene growing.
Fantastic. And obviously the Amiga Kit website, you know, if people want to buy new hardware for their classic machines, you've got a massive selection on there as well, which I'll link up in the show notes. Well, Matt, it's been incredible catching up with you. Best of luck with the A600GS.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you at a few events over the summer.
Yes, I'm looking forward to seeing you guys and sharing a beer sometime.
Yeah, it goes without saying. Well, thanks for coming on, Matthew. Lovely to talk to you.
Great to talk to you.